We're starting chapter 6 of Jane Eyre. The next day commenced as before, getting up and dressing by rushlight, but this morning we were obliged to dispense with the ceremony of washing. The water in the pitchers was frozen. A change had taken place in the weather in the preceding evening, and a keen northeast wind, whistling through the crevices of our bedroom windows all night long, had made us shiver in our beds and turned the contents of the ewers to ice. Before the long hour and a half of prayers and Bible reading was over, I felt ready to perish with cold. Breakfast time came at last, and this morning the porridge was not burnt. The quality was eatable, the portion small. How small my portion seemed. I wish it had been doubled. In the course of the day I was enrolled, a member of the fourth class, and regular tasks and occupations were assigned me. Hitherto I had only been a spectator of the proceedings at Lowood. I was now to become an actor therein. At first, being little accustomed to learn by heart, the lessons appeared to me both long and difficult. The frequent change from task to task, too, bewildered me, and I was glad when, at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Miss Smith put into my hands a border of muslin 2 yards long, together with needle, thimble, etc., and sent me to sit in a quiet corner of the schoolroom with directions to hem the same. At that hour most of the others were sewing likewise, but one class stood still round Miss Scratchard's chair reading, and as all was quiet, the subject of their lessons could be heard, together with the manner in which each girl acquitted herself, and the animadversions or commendations of Miss Scratchard on their performance. It was English history. Among the readers I observed my acquaintance on the veranda. At the commencement of the lesson, her place had been at the top of the class, but for some error in pronunciation, or some inattention to stops, she was suddenly sent to the very bottom. Even in that obscure position, Miss Scratchard continued to make her an object of constant notice, for she was continually addressing to her such phrases as the following. Burns, such it seems, was her name. The girls here were all called by their surnames, as boys are elsewhere. Burns, you are standing on the side of your shoe. Turn your toes out immediately. Burns, you poke your chin most unpleasantly. Draw it in. Burns, I insist on holding your head up. I will not have you before me in that attitude. Etc., etc. A chapter having been read through twice, the books were closed and the girls examined. The lesson had comprised the part of the reign of Charles I, and there were sundry questions about tonnage and poundage and ship money, which most of them appeared unable to answer. Still, every little difficulty was solved instantly when it reached Burns. Her memory seemed to have retained the substance of the whole lesson, and she was ready with answers on every point. I kept expecting that Miss Scratchard would praise her attention, but instead of that she suddenly cried out, "You dirty, disagreeable girl, you have never cleaned your nails this morning." Burns made no answer. I wondered at her silence. Why, thought I, did she not explain that she could neither clean her nails nor wash her face, as the water was frozen? My attention was now called off by Miss Smith, desiring me to hold a skein of thread. While she was winding it, she talked to me from time to time, asking whether I'd ever been at school before, whether I could mark, stitch, knit, etc. Till she dismissed me, I could not pursue my observations on Miss Scratchard's movements. When I returned to my seat, that lady was just delivering an order, of which I did not catch the import. But Burns immediately left the class, and going into the small inner room where the books were kept, returned in half a minute, carrying in her hand a bundle of twigs tied together at one end. This ominous tool she presented to Miss Scratchard with respectful courtesy, and then she quietly, without being told, unloosed her pinafore, and the teacher instantly and sharply inflicted on her neck, a dozen strokes with a bunch of twigs. Not a tear rose to Burns's eye, and while I paused for my sewing, because my fingers quivered at the spectacle with a sentiment of unveiling and impotent anger, not a feature of her pensive face altered its ordinary expression. "Hardened girl," exclaimed Miss Scratchard, "nothing can correct you from your slatternly habits. Carry this rod away." Burns obeyed. I looked at her narrowly as she emerged from the book closet. She was just putting back her handkerchief into her pocket, and the trace of a tear glistened on her thin cheek. The play hour in the evening I thought the pleasantest fraction of the day at Lowood. The bit of bread, the draught of coffee swallowed at 5 o'clock, had revived vitality. If it had not satisfied hunger, the long restraint of the day was slackened. The schoolroom felt warmer than in the morning, its fires being allowed to burn a little more brightly, to supply, in some measure, the place of candles not yet introduced. The ruddy gloaming, the licensed uproar, the confusion of many voices gave one a welcome sense of liberty. On the evening of the day on which I had seen Miss Scratchard flog her pupil Burns, I wandered as usual among the forms and tables and laughing groups without a companion, yet not feeling lonely. When I passed the windows, I now and then lifted a blind and looked out. It snowed fast. A drift was already forming against the lower panes. Putting my ear close to the window, I could distinguish from the gleeful tumult within the disconsolate moan of the wind outside. Probably, if I had lately left a good home and kind parents, this would have been the hour when I should most keenly have regretted the separation. That wind would have saddened my heart. This obscure chaos would have disturbed my peace. As it was, I derived from both a strange excitement, and reckless and feverish, I wished the wind to howl more wildly, the gloom to deepen the darkness, and the confusion to rise to clamor. Jumping over forms, and creeping under tables, I made my way to one of the fireplaces. There, kneeling by the high wire fender, I found Burns, absorbed, silent, abstracted from all around her by the companionship of a book, which she read by the dim glare of the embers. "Is it still Rasselas?" I asked, coming behind her. "Yes," she said, "and I've just finished it." And in 5 minutes more she shut it up. I was glad of this. Now, thought I, now, perhaps, I can get her to talk. I sat down by her on the floor. "What is your name besides Burns?"
"Helen."
"Do you come from a long way from here?"
"I come from a place farther north, quite on the borders of Scotland."
"Will you ever go back?"
"I hope so, but nobody can be sure of the future."
"You must wish to leave Lowood."
"No, why should I? I was sent to Lowood to get an education, and it would be of no use getting away until I have attained that object."
"But that teacher, Miss Scratchard, is so cruel to you."
"Cruel, not at all. She's severe. She dislikes my faults."
"And if I were in your place, I should dislike her. I should resist her. If she struck me with that rod, I should get it from her hand and break it under her nose."
"Probably you would do nothing of that sort, but if you did, Mr. Brocklehurst would expel you from the school. That would be a great relief to your relations. It is far better to endure patiently a smart which nobody feels but yourself, than to commit a hasty action whose evil consequences will extend to all connected with you. And besides, the Bible bids us return good for evil."
"But then it seems disgraceful to be flogged, and to be sent to stand in the middle of a room full of people. And you are such a great girl. I am far younger than you, and I could not bear it."
"Yet it would be your duty to bear it, if you could not avoid it. It is weak and silly to say you cannot bear what is your fate to be required to bear."
I heard her with wonder. I could not comprehend this doctrine of endurance, and still less could I understand or sympathize with the forbearance she expressed for her chastiser. Still, I felt that Helen Burns considered things by a light invisible to my eyes. I suspected that she might be right and I wrong, but I would not ponder the matter deeply. Like Felix, I put it off to a more convenient season.
"You say you have faults, Helen. What are they? To me you seem very good."
"Then learn from me not to judge by appearances. I am, as Miss Scratchard says, slatternly. I seldom put and never keep things in order. I'm careless. I forget rules. I read when I should learn my lessons. I have no method. And sometimes I say, like you, I cannot bear to be subjected to systematic arrangements. This is all very provoking to Miss Scratchard, who is naturally neat, punctual, and particular."
"And cruel and cross," I added, but Helen Burns would not admit my addition. She kept silence.
"Is Miss Temple as severe to you as Miss Scratchard?"
At the utterance of Miss Temple's name, a soft smile flitted over her grave face.
"Miss Temple is full of goodness. It pains her to be severe to anyone, even the worst in the school. She sees my errors and tells me of them gently, and if I do anything worse of praise, she gives me my meed liberally.
One strong proof of my wretchedly defective nature is that even her expostulations, so mild, so rational, cannot influence to cure me of my faults. And even her praise, though I value it most highly, cannot stimulate me to continued care and foresight. That is curious, said I. It is so easy to be careful. For you, it is, I have no doubt, it is. I observed you in class this morning, and I saw you were closely attentive. Your thoughts never seemed to wander while Miss Miller explained the lessons and questioned you. Now, mine continually rove away, where I should be listening to Miss Scratchard, and collecting all she says with assiduity. I often lose the very sound of her voice. I fall into sort of a dream. Sometimes I think I am in Northumberland, and that the noises I hear round me are the bubbling of a little brook which runs through Deepden, near our house. Then, when it comes to my turn to reply, I have to be awakened, and have heard nothing of what was read for listening to the visionary brook. I have no answer ready. Yet how well you replied this afternoon. It was mere chance. The subject on which we had been reading had interested me. This afternoon, instead of dreaming of Deepden, I was wondering how a man who wished to do so right could act so unjustly and unwisely as Charles I sometimes did. And I thought what a pity it was that, with his integrity and conscientiousness, he could see no farther than the prerogatives of the crown. If he had but been able to look at to a distance and see how what they call the spirit of the age was tending. Still, I like Charles. I respect him. I pity him, poor murdered king. Yes, his enemies were the worst. They shed blood they had no right to shed. How dare they kill him? Helen was talking to herself now. She had forgotten I could not very well understand her, that I was ignorant, or nearly so, of the subject she discussed. I recalled her to my level. And when Miss Temple teaches you, do your thoughts wander then? No, certainly not often, because Miss Temple has generally something to say which is newer than my own reflections. Her language is singularly agreeable to me, and the information she communicates is often just what I wish to gain. Well then, with Miss Temple you are good? Yes, in a passive way. I make no effort. I follow as inclination guides me. There is no merit in such goodness. A great deal you are good to those who are good to you. It is all I ever desire to be. If people were always kind and obedient to those who are cruel and unjust, the wicked people would have it all to their own way. They would never feel afraid, and so would never alter, but would grow worse and worse. When we are struck at without reason, we should strike back again very hard. I'm sure we should. So hard as to teach the person who struck us never to do it again. You will change your mind, I hope, when you grow older. As yet, you are but a little untaught girl. But I feel this, Helen. I must dislike those who, whatever I do to please them, persist in disliking me. I must resist those who punish me unjustly. It is as natural as that I should love those who show me affection, or submit to punishment when I feel it is deserved. Heathens and savage tribes hold that doctrine, but Christians and civilized nations disown it. How? I don't understand. It is not violence that best overcomes hate, nor vengeance that most certainly heals injury. What then? Read the New Testament, and observe what Christ says, how he acts, makes his word your rule, and his conduct your example. What does he say? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you and despitefully use you. Then I should love Mrs. Reed, which I cannot do. I should bless her son John, which is impossible. In her turn, Helen Burns asked me to explain, and I proceeded forthwith to pour out, in my own way, my tale of sufferings and resentments. Bitter and truculent when excited, I spoke as I felt, without reserve or softening. Helen heard me patiently to the end. I expected she would then make a remark, but she said nothing. Well, I asked impatiently, is not Mrs. Reed a hard-hearted, bad woman? She has been unkind to you, no doubt, because, you see, she dislikes your cast of character, as Miss Scratcher does mine. But how minutely you remember all she has done and said to you. What a singularly deep impression her injustice seems to have made on your heart. No ill usage so brands its record on my feelings. Would you not be happier if you tried to forget her severity, together with the passionate emotions it excited? Life appears to me too short to be spent in nursing animosity or registering wrongs. We are, and must be, one and all, burdened with faults in this world. But the time will soon come when, I trust, we shall be put them off in putting off our corruptible bodies, when debasement and sin will fall from us with this cumbrous frame of flesh, and only the spark of the spirit will remain, the impalpable principle of light and thought, pure as when it left the Creator to inspire the creature. Whence it came, it will return, perhaps again, to be communicated to some being higher than man, perhaps to pass through gradations of glory, from the pale human soul to brighten to the seraph. Surely it will never, on the contrary, be suffered to degenerate from man to fiend. No, I cannot believe that. I hold another creed which no one ever taught me, which I seldom mention, but in which I delight, and to which I cling. For it extends hope to all, it makes eternity a rest, a mighty home, not a terror, an abyss. Besides, with this creed, I can so clearly distinguish between the criminal and his crime. I can so sincerely forgive the first while I abhor the last. With this creed, revenge never worries my heart. Degradation never too deeply disgusts me. Injustice never crushes me too low. I live in calm, looking to the end. Helen's head, always drooping, sank a little lower when she finished the sentence. I saw by her look she wished no longer to talk to me, but rather to converse with her own thoughts. She was not allowed much time for meditation. A monitor, a rough, great girl, presently came up to her, examining in a strong Cumberland accent. "Helen Burns, if you don't go and put your drawer in order and fold up your work this minute, I'll tell Miss Scratcher to come and look at it." Helen sighed as her reverie fled, and getting up, obeyed the monitor without reply, as without delay. And that's the end of chapter 6. And I hope you like that, my beautiful boo. It's bedtime now. Sweet dreams.